From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You could say Walter Kern was in a vulnerable state when he first encountered the man named Clark Rockefeller. They met on a phone call. Clark was odd, but interesting. A secretive international banker and art dealer from a famous family. Kern was a writer in between books, and at first he saw the man as a character with a story. He did end up writing about Clark, but not right away. It was 15 years later when the man was revealed to be an imposter, a German immigrant who had scripted a new identity. And not only that, he was a child kidnapper and a murderer, too. Today in the program, Walter Kern is with us to talk about his new book, how being fooled reoriented his life and revealed what he calls the power of his ignorance and vanity. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. I'm sure it's a question the writer Walter Kern gets all the time. How did you fall for Clark Rockefeller's story? Kern first encounters this man in 1998 when he agrees to deliver a crippled dog to him in Manhattan. And he was eccentric and flamboyant, said he was a banker and art dealer, and then, of course, there was the name, the famous family. In his latest book, Walter Kern writes about how the story unravels, how Rockefeller is unmasked as this German immigrant who had made up a persona, who fashioned a life of cinematic moments, as he puts it. He was an imposter who turns out to be also a brutal murderer. And Walter Kern says, people often wonder why he didn't just Google the guy. But this, of course, was in the days before all of that, a time when he says you took people at face value. A good part of the book, though, is about why it was that he was taken in by the story. And he says the experience reoriented everything. The book is called Blood Will Out. And Walter Kern is joining us today to talk about it. Walter Kern has written five novels, including, of course, Thumbsucker and Up in the Air. His work has appeared in GQ and Esquire, The Atlantic.
Hi there.
Welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Great to be here.
We were talking off the air. I kind of wanted to start there about something we were talking about off the air, and that is the sort of the initial sort of knee-jerk reaction that people are having to this story. That how could you have been taken in by that? And in fact, a lot of the reaction has been kind of hostile to the idea that in fact you had been taken in by it.
Yeah, that surprises me. You know, all cons are transparent in retrospect. I mean, Bernie Madoff took, you know, billions and billions of dollars from some of the richest and most influential people in the country, Steven Spielberg included. And only afterwards, after he was exposed, did people notice that his last name was Madoff. You know, I mean, everybody seems fishy once you know they're a criminal. But I was fooled in the same way that everybody is by a determined con man. He used credentials. He, you know, was the member of private clubs that called him Mr. Rockefeller. He, you know, had art on his walls that appeared to be worth tens of millions of dollars. Who would have guessed that it was fake? I think people have a real sort of ego attachment to the notion that they are discerning and that they can tell a fake. And of course, we only know a fake once they've been exposed. You and I may have fakes in our lives right now who have yet to be revealed. People are always learning things in divorce proceedings about their mate that they couldn't imagine were true at the time. But people seem to find it uniquely threatening, this notion that that someone could be taken in at this level. And not only threatening, they flat don't believe it. I mean, I'm here to tell them it happened, and they're usually not speaking from experience. I had the experience. No one knew who this guy was. I mean, he was a member of the most elite private clubs. He traveled in the highest echelons of Boston and New York society for decades. And yet I'm supposed to somehow be defrauding the public by saying that I was defrauded. It's a blame the victim thing. It's a little like how they used to treat rape. You know, it had to be your fault or you had to want it.
But isn't part of the book about the fact that you did want it? I mean, it was about the just in the sense that it was about your own sense of vanity and that you had. I mean, because a lot of this you sort of talk about your own personal reaction to it and your own the own things in your own personality that made you a victim, I guess.
The book has a thesis that every con is a two-way street, that every deception involves two parties. I, as his dupe or victim, played a role in it. And I sort of forensically examined my role with the benefit of the murder trial that ultimately came out in which his M.O. was dissected. Now, what was my part in it? Did I want, as a writer, first of all, have some insight into the world of the Rockefellers? Yes. Did I, as a kid from Minnesota who grew up on a farm and went east to Princeton and felt a little snubbed by the fancy types, want to be accepted by someone who represented that sort of Eastern establishment? Yes. Was I fascinated by this guy's storytelling ability and his sort of enchanting manner, his romantic notion of himself and of the world? Yes, I was. You know, I was seduced. And everybody who is seduced is in some sense ready to be. But, you know, am I lying about the fact that I was, that it was an honest seduction? No.
Yeah, that's strange. Let's talk about where you were at the time. This is 1998. You're living in Montana.
Yeah.
A ranch that you bought something like, it was 10 miles just outside of Livingston.
Right.
You had arrived in 1990 from New York. You went there to do this story. You end up staying.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that, because you say it was kind of you were living a kind of strange existence at the time.
Yeah. So I graduated from Princeton in 1983. I went to Oxford University. I came back to New York City in the mid-'80s. I worked at magazines. And after a few years, I got tired of the city and – there was a sort of Western literary outpost in Montana. There still is.
Yeah.
And I was out there on a trip, and I thought, wow, this place is, you know, inexpensive. It reminds me of the country, Minnesota, the sort of countryside where I grew up. A writer can live here and sort of fraternize more freely than in New York. And I stayed. I bought this ranch with some sort of Hemingway romantic notion of being, a rugged guy. It was too much money, and the mortgage was weighing on my mind at the time. I had a child on the way. This is 1998 by now. I'd sort of cornered myself with my own romantic notion of myself.
And, of course, you're in between books when you have this phone call with this kind of flamboyant, weird guy.
Yeah, I'm in between books, which I compare to being a merchant marine between ships. You're sort of hanging out at the docks, and anything that looks like trouble, amusement, or intrigue is going to turn your head. The Humane Society there, which was run by my wife at the time, gets in a crippled dog that can't move except in a wheelchair and puts it up for adoption on the internet. Gets a call from New York City. A guy identifies himself as Clark Rockefeller, says, among other things, that he lives next door to Tony Bennett, that he has access to the best canine acupuncturist in New York, and he would love to have the dog. It's a Gordon Setter. He, in fact, has another dog of this breed. The only problem, he says, is that he can't come get it because he doesn't drive, and his private plane is indisposed in China with his wife that summer. And the Humane Society came to me to talk to him because they thought, because I'd lived in New York and knew this sort of strata of person somewhat at Princeton, I might be able to figure out what to do. And I did, and that was drive him the dog.
Right. Which itself is this one of the best parts of the book, I have to say, in some ways for me, just this epic track that you make, in a lovely way, I think, to get into the story, to be honest with you.
Well, it's the true beginning of the story, and it's a lovely way. You know, hey, I'm a writer. I'm alert to the possibilities of real life in terms of making a good story. And frankly, I was alert to it when I decided to take the drive. You know, there's a book called Travels with Charlie. Yep. John Steinbeck travels the United States with his dog. And I thought, I'm getting into a truck with a dog to deliver it to a Rockefeller in New York City, and I'm going to go across the plains in some of the most austere parts of America. This could be some kind of narrative someday.
You're probably always thinking like that.
I'm always thinking like that. If I'm doing something, if I'm choosing to do something for more than 2 days, which isn't like lie on the beach, I'm thinking about writing about it. Sure.
There's this section where you mention a reference bringing that copy of Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie with you. Read this section for us, will you?
Yeah, the Steinbeck book was not what I expected. My impression was that it consisted of folksy sketches of charming American characters and scenes, but it was gloomier than that. In a section set in Minnesota, Steinbeck drives an evacuation route intended to help people survive a nuclear war. He calls it a road designed by fear. He crosses the Canadian border and then re-enters the United States, grumbling about the stern, impersonal guards and how modern governments diminish people. He frets that TV is flattening the culture and voices disgust at materialism and wastefulness. Pretty much the only state that pleases him because it seems clean and honest and unspoiled is Montana, the place that I'd just left. The book depressed me. It brimmed with fears about the future that had mostly come true. I put it down. My phone was turned off because those were still the days when turning a phone off wasn't considered hiding. My silence would have to assure Clark I was coming. When I finally showed up with Shelby, if we made it, if the sounds she was making in her sleep weren't symptoms of a failing nervous system, he'd witness a marvel that no one ever tires of, faith in a stranger rewarded in full measure. He trusted me, who trusted very few, and he was right to trust me, for here I was, heading his way through the hot Montana badlands, where dinosaur fossils lay scattered across dry creek beds and pale ribbed fingers of eroded stone offered moody perches to hawks and vultures. Still, I felt a rising qualm, not about Clark, about myself. Would it be wrong to write about him someday, if I masked his identity? If I changed his name? He knew I was a writer. We discussed it. He'd even done some scribbling himself. But did he know what a writer really is? Probably not. Few people do. A writer is someone who tells you one thing, so someday he can tell his readers another thing, what he was thinking but declined to say, or what he would have thought had he been wiser. A writer turns his life into material, and if you're in his life, he uses yours, too.
You explain in the book that there was there's a moment when you decided you weren't going to write about him, or at least you weren't going to use him as a character. And it was at this club in Manhattan, this Lotus Club. Talk a little bit about that, this idea when you figured, I mean, you go there like this could be great. This could be a book. This could be something I might, as you say in there, I might.
Yeah.
But you decide not to, at least not at first.
Well, this may be where my vanity comes in, but also my small-town upbringing. I mean, I grew up in a town of 500 people. We trusted everyone. If a stranger came by with candy, we ate it because there were no real strangers. Anyway, once I met this guy in New York and hung out with him a little bit, I noticed two things. First, he was obsessed with his privacy and his security, and to write about him would expose him perhaps to some danger or at least some anxiety. Yeah. Number two, he seemed like a guy I'd rather hang out with and learn more about and, you know, experience a strange corner of the world with than someone I'd burn with a piece of writing that, you know, would be forgotten and the guy would be offended and so on. So, I stepped back from that plan.
How do you describe the relationship that you had? In the book, you say that you brought him news of the people, the human ruckus, as you put it, and he brought you news from the Olympian eagle's nest. Like, he was your sort of, not your access to the elite, but he represented something like that connection, which is a conflicted issue for you, I think.
Well, it is conflicted. Here I'm a guy who went to Oxford who lives in Montana. Yeah. Doesn't that tell you the whole story? The fact is that Clark was interested in a couple things, especially about me. won my ranch, won Montana. He wanted to know what life was like there. He was interested in cowboys. He had a kind of romantic notion of, you know, Western ranching and tough guy behavior. Number two, wanted to know about me as a writer. He told me very early that he wrote himself, that he hoped to publish something someday, and we talked a lot about that. What I got from him was strange and crazy stories. I mean, this guy was somebody who pretended to be friends, and I thought he was telling the truth, with admirals, an admiral of the Navy 7th Fleet who told him there was a secret plan by China to invade Taiwan that was going to take place any year now. I thought I was getting the sort of high-level insider gossip of, you know, the Globe. And I'm going to say that because I was at Oxford and Princeton, I had met people not unlike him before. I knew Princess Di's brother at Oxford, and they're kooky often. I mean, they're often eccentric, insecure. They believe that they're on the inside of things that they aren't really. He bore a family resemblance to all of these very fancy, rich, aristocratic types I'd met in the past.
When do you remember the moment when you you realized he was a fraud? What was the that moment of revelation? Do you remember that first time when you realized?
Well, it happened after 10 years.
Yeah.
I mean, somewhere in the middle of those 10 years, I realized he was a pest. I realized he wasn't a true friend. It was, don't call me, I'll call you. He'd give me phone numbers that didn't work and then call me at the oddest times. He had a greeting that was very strange. Walter, long time no speak. You know, spoken like that, like a cousin of Katharine Hepburn's, I say in the book.
Yeah.
And, you know, we went out to dinner one night where he forgot his wallet after, you know, making sure we ordered dessert. I realized, didn't listen very well to me, except when he had a very specific question. Mostly he used me as an audience to regale me with these sort of conspiracy theories and tales and biographical reminiscences. And, you know, I distanced myself from him, but I didn't realize he was a fake until the entire world realized he was a fake. And that was in 2008 after he kidnapped his non-custodial daughter. The FBI went hunting for him, and the Rockefeller family came out publicly and disavowed him. And I did not believe the Rockefeller family at first.
Right.
You know, but rapidly his house of cards fell apart, and I had to admit that I was dealing with a completely synthesized person who had pulled the wool not over my eyes, but all the way down to my knees.
Walter Kern is with us. He is the writer and critic, of course. The book is called Blood Will Out: The True Story of a Murder, a Mystery, and a Masquerade. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer Walter Kern is with us. Kern, you may remember, is the author of Thumbsucker and Up in the Air. His latest book is about his friendship with a man he knew as Clark Rockefeller, a man who had a great story, and pretty much all of it was a lie. Not only was he a fraud, though, he was also a murderer. And in the book, Kern tries to work out how he could have been taken in by him. A good part of it, he confesses, has to do with his own vanity. The book is called Blood Will Out: The True Story of a Murder, a Mystery, and a Masquerade. I wanted to ask you about, in the book you write about his, Clark Rockefeller's connection to this, you know, the shape-shifting trickster of American literature. I wanted to ask you a little bit about that. Because he knew he sort of belonged to that type in some way. He said he was even kind of proud of it.
Well, you know, later on in the story, when I resume my relationship with him after he's been exposed, he tells me, and this is only about a year ago, that he based his entire life in America on The Great Gatsby. It was given to him when he was 10 to teach him English, because he's actually a German. He grew up in Germany. He came over here at 17. And, you know, maybe he told me that story because he knew I was a writer and he knew I was from Minnesota like Fitzgerald and he thought it might interest me. But he demonstrably based his life and his crimes on a series of fictional characters, I think including Tom Ripley, the hero of Talented Mr. Ripley, or the villain, actually. He comes in a long line of self-invented social aspirants who try with the right dress, the right line of patter, and the right phony voice to leap right to the top of the American social pyramid. And he actually showed how easy it is to do. I mean, this was a guy who walked into investment banks and got jobs trading bonds after having never been to college, barely knowing what a bond was. You know, so you know, America's positive spin on self-invention is the immigrant experience, you know, people pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. The dark side of it is the Duke and the Dauphin and Huckleberry Finn, the Music Man, Melville's The Confidence Man, the Great Gatsby, the person who, from humble origins, remakes themselves as a posh person and pays a terrible price for it.
His life in Germany comes out. I mean, I guess he sort of crafts his path forward. He figures, I'm going to start as an exchange student. He starts in Connecticut.
Yeah.
Makes his way to Milwaukee. Makes his way to California. Mm-hmm. Is it all laid out, do you think, in some way?
Well, there's a logic that you can impute to it in retrospect. He was hitchhiking in Germany. He's 17 years old in the rain, and he meets a couple of Americans who pick him up, and they're from Connecticut. At the end of their visit, they tell him, call if you're ever in the U.S. 2 weeks later, he calls them. He goes to the state where he knows two people already. Then, after having kind of fabricated an identity, first as a British aristocrat, maybe the accent was easier for a German, who knows, mm-hmm. he moves on to Milwaukee, a city where he probably could speak German when he wanted to and, you know, might be comfortable with the food, the culture, who knows. There he studies film noir and film at a university and gets a green card by marrying a girl just for that purpose. And then he makes his big move, which, you know, is the big American move, California, you know, Hollywood.
He ends up in this guest house of Didi Sohus.
Yeah.
Is that the name? Is that
Sohus.
Sohus. Which is really interesting because you write about how he goes and he hangs out at a barbershop, for example, in town.
Yeah.
Becomes a kind of moocher. But I guess all this time he's sort of... And I have to ask you about this. He told people he owned a talking car?
Yeah. No, here's a guy who, as I say, borrowed most of his stories and most of his, embellishments from TV and the movies. There was a show called Knight Rider on in those days about a talking car, starred David Hasselhoff.
Yeah.
He told a few people he owned one himself. That story reportedly didn't go down too well. People said, oh, come on, you know. But that just sounds like BS. It doesn't. But in any case, the way he worked it when he got to California is he moved to this very rich sort of Episcopalian suburb, San Marino, near Pasadena. And this barbershop he would hang out with was the place where the Chandler men, the publishers of the L.A. Times, hung out. A lot of rich people. And he heard the gossip and he kept his head down and read the newspaper in the corner. And, you know, every once in a while someone invited him to lunch. And he went to the Episcopal Church that was, you know, the sort of pinnacle of high society in that burg. And he, you know, made his way into the old ladies' lunch circle. And, you know, that's how he worked it.
And he's not crazy about his landlady's son.
Well,
do we know about that? I mean, this is the man he ends up killing.
Yeah. So he's living in a guest house, and his landlady is hosting her 27-year-old son and daughter-in-law in the main house. The son and daughter-in-law want to move into the guest house. They wish the boarder would leave, but apparently he's not going anywhere. There's no evidence that Clark, I'll call him Clark.
Yeah,
at the time, he was calling himself Chris Chichester, 13th Baronet of England. There's no evidence he knew the son and daughter very well. But He certainly knew of them. They were living right there, but we don't have any record of them meeting or conversing. In any case, he hatched a plan for, murdering and disposing of these two people, and then he executed that plan.
Yeah. You say that when you learned that Clark might be a murderer, you say the effect on you was Galilean.
Yes.
It humbled you, it reoriented everything. What do you mean?
We're used to people turning out not to be who they say they are. We're even used to finding out that people are capable of criminal behavior. But when I heard that he was a murderer and that he'd been living in a guest house when he'd committed the murder, I immediately thought back to a couple months after I'd met him when he had asked to live in my guest house on my ranch in Montana. I was a newly married, part of a newly married couple, like the one that had disappeared. And when I heard the details of the murder, yeah, I went, Walter, you didn't just get this guy wrong. You placed yourself in some unknown danger that could have just been horrible. I suddenly realized that my ability to read people, my ability to sense danger from others was less than zero.
He said it softened you. Unsettled you, but softened you.
Well, any exposure of your weakness and it softens you. I mean, it's a blow to the ego. It's a blow to the pride. It took my pride right out from under me. I'm a journalist. I'm used to sort of confrontational, skeptical relationships with people in which I try to get at the truth and they try to hide it or they try to spin it in a certain way. And here, I just utterly failed in a way that was, kind of world class. And so, of course, it took me down a peg, that's for sure.
Well, and then the reaction becomes deeply personal. And there's a lot of the book is about this part, how the shock, as you put it, of Clark's unmasking kept coming at you as in waves. You said it didn't just wear off. And you refer to all the shocks that you had since befriending him. And I wanted to talk about that, the sort of this trauma of that came along with this unmasking.
Yeah.
One in particular, which may be difficult to talk about, but it's at your ranch the day after your 40th birthday, and you almost run over your little son, Charlie.
Yeah, I do run over him. I run over him in the truck that I use to deliver the dog. It's a four-wheel drive F-350 Ford pickup truck. It's up high on, sort of thick suspension. And somebody sees me driving over him before I see it. I couldn't see him sitting right in front of the front bumper. He's only 1 year old. And as I get out of the truck, I walk around the back thinking I've killed him. Yeah. And there he is sitting upright between the tires, having had the whole truck pass over him without hurting him. That was a devastating moment. During the time, in some ways this book is my autobiography during the years I happened to know Clark. And there were a lot of difficult moments. And the one in which I realized my friend is a murderer sort of capped them off and stood for the others in some way. It was, it was a period in my 30s when life's hard parts started revealing themselves.
Yeah. Your mother dies relatively young from an abscess in the brain. It's one of the other things. Because you talk about how this accident sort of sends a tremor through your life.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, in another attempt to account for where my head was at during the time I knew Clark, I have to recount some of the things that happened to me. Yeah. My mother died very suddenly. I'd just seen her, and all of a sudden she collapses from an abscess that no one knew, and next time I see her, she's in a coma, and, she's having to basically take morphine and be eased from her pain. I had a lot of these things happen in those years, and it didn't help once Clark was revealed that I stopped trusting people. Mm-hmm. I remember a plumber who wanted to come into my house shortly after, the news of this murder. He said, I'll just take a key while you're on vacation. No way. I remember online dating had come into being, and sitting at my computer looking at the profiles of people that I might go on dates with and thinking, how do I know any of these people are real? You know, in some ways, there's an undercurrent in this book of the way society has changed, too. You know, I got my first cell phone in 1998 on that trip to deliver the dog. By 2008, I'm living in the world of social media, smartphones, online dating, online everything, in which, you know, people do Google each other after meeting,
yeah.
And in which other people game Google, knowing they're going to be Googled, in order to put the best results up top. You know, the world of conning and duping and masking yourself has only gotten more complex and befuddling in that time.
You described the fact, I thought this was really interesting, that the fact that you had been fooled as a kind of spiritual laxity.
Yes.
What you regard as your trusting nature, you say, turned out to be something other than you thought it was. It turned out to be sloth, is how you put it.
Yeah. You know, we live in a society in which it's often easier to believe the best about people than it is to take a penetrating look at who they are and what we really want from them. You know, rather than search myself about this friendship, and I'm not talking about doing a background check on Clark Rockefeller, which really just never occurred to me. I never looked at what the basis of this friendship really was. It was very one way. Often we do this romantically. We meet somebody, we hear their, you know, their sort of cover story about how great they are, and we don't press any further because we'd like it to be true, and we'd like to have a friction-free instant bonding with them. In America, we love instant intimacy and instant friendship, and, you know, what we call trust is often just disinterest in doing due diligence.
Yeah. You say it was a selfish craving for an alliance. He could count on me.
Yeah, yeah. I, looking back, am startled by the number of times I wanted to reassure this guy that I could be trusted. You know, people ask the question, why did you trust him? But I was more concerned that he trust me. When I delivered that dog and actually showed up with it, I felt like I had really, you know, that was a win for the human race. You know, here I'd shown myself to be reliable. When he said, you're not going to write about this, are you? And I said, oh, of course not. And I meant it. I felt that was a true blue gesture on my part. I was constantly wanting to be worthy of the trust he put in me. Now, that may sound like the worst form of masochism or Boy Scoutism. I don't know. But it was a real thought.
Well, I guess he was pretty good at it.
It was all he'd ever done.
You know what I mean? Well, one of the things you say that you played the role of the ideal audience. Here's something you write. You said you were helping him kind of refine his stories.
Right, right.
And you said these characters read you according to the books, and all the time they're talking, they're really listening.
Yeah.
So you're giving him these stories. He's listening for pings and echoes.
Yeah.
You say they use sonar, not questions. I mean, he never asked you questions, he said, but he was sending you out these things.
Yes.
And you were giving it back to him, and he was figuring it out.
At his murder trial, the young man who had lived with him when he'd been an exchange student got up and testified as to how Clark had at first assembled his early persona. And he would basically sit around the kitchen and tell stories and say, does that one work? Does that one work? He'd try out an accent that was based on Thurston Howell III of Gilligan's Island, the millionaire, and sort of ask for reviews of it. You know, he used test audiences early on. And I think I was one of his test audiences. You know, he'd tell me stories that he'd concocted in private and see whether I flinched or, you know, my eyes glazed over or whether I was bored. He also would see, I think, whether or not I sort of lit up at any of these things, you know. Where were my weaknesses? Where was my greed? Where was my vanity located? As I say, you know, asking questions might have been suspicious, but studying my face as he gave his monologues was a very good way to find out who I was.
Walter Kern is with us. His new book, Blood Will Out, The True Story of a Murder, a Mystery, and a Masquerade. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Walter Kern. We're talking about his latest book, Blood Will Out, The True Story of a Murder, a Mystery, and a Masquerade. When did you decide you wanted to go to the trial, like that it was important you went to this trial?
So he was investigated for this murder that took place in 1985, beginning in 2008. So it was clear there was going to be a trial unless he pled guilty. It didn't take place until 2013.
Right.
I'd started the book in about 2010 with the story of the dog, but I realized I couldn't go any further with it until it was decided whether or not, in the eyes of the law, he was a murderer. Mm. Now, I believed, for various reasons, that he was definitely guilty. But for all kinds of reasons, maybe the one being not having to use the word alleged 1,000 times,
right.
I wanted to know how his story ended. You know, you can't really write a story until you know something about the ending. So, but it was my editor at Norton who said, you have to go to this trial. And he sort of reminded me of the Truman Capote book, In Cold Blood, and said, you know, maybe you could write about the trial for The New Yorker as Capote did. And I ended up doing that.
You did.
Yeah.
So there's this moment right at the beginning. He catches your eye in the trial at first.
Yeah.
And you kind of nod to him. You hadn't seen him in how long at this point?
I hadn't seen him in 8 years,
yeah,
probably.
8 years.
And he'd been in jail since 2008, and now it's March 2013. And he turned around in his seat to look at a prospective juror who was being interviewed by the judge, and I was sitting right there, you know, 6 feet away. And we locked eyes, and he sneered at me as though I had offended against the code of gentlemen by showing up at this hour of embarrassment for him. What was I doing there? It was like an involuntary animal sneer of just disgust.
So being at the trial, aside from helping you complete the story, did you see this as an opportunity to what? I mean, because you talk about there are these questions you wanted to get at.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of these things, like, why was he so impressive? Why did I at least think he was so impressive at first? And
well, the major evidence in the trial was an account of his life since 1985, between 1985 and in 2008. And it was an attempt to show that he was fleeing and hiding some major secret. And so the trial brought together people who'd known him in all kinds of places over decades. And it was kind of like a reunion of suckers who'd never met each other before. In other words, Clark kept everybody apart so he could manipulate them individually and so they couldn't cross-reference what he told them. But here they all were in one room.
Yeah.
It was like a family reunion of the most dysfunctional family of all time, Clark Rockefeller's victims. And I wanted to be there and compare notes, and I wanted to hear how he'd done it with others. And I also wanted to find out more about him. This was just going to unearth so much information that I wouldn't get otherwise.
You also say you wanted to know how it is that his character could be so related to the violent part of him.
Yes. See, there are a lot of murderers, and we're used to serial killers, and it's our daily diet on TV and so on. But I don't know of one real-life killer who also cut up his victim and wrapped them in bags, who dressed out of the preppy handbook. I don't know anyone, in other words, who's sort of cool, aristocratic, preppy demeanor was matched with a Jeffrey Dahmer-like savagery.
Yeah.
And the polls between exterior and interior were as far apart as they can be in a human being. And I wanted to somehow put them back together, integrate them, because it was, you know, it's a mind bender to think that a guy who you sat drinking gin and tonics with in private clubs in New York City and Boston, you know, probably cut somebody up with a chainsaw and wrapped them in bags and buried them in their mother's yard.
There's this a moment in the trial that they where they play this clip from the Today Show.
Yeah.
Give me a sense of what you made of seeing that clip in the context of now knowing the truth. Because you talk about how he wasn't much of an actor, but he was a pretty good director in the sense that he was using these props and this reliance on atmosphere, all of that kind of stuff.
Right.
And the moment in this clip is kind of revealing because somebody asks him in this clip what his name is, or he reveals his name to be Clark. And they say, your name is Clark Rockefeller, knowing, in fact, that it's not at
yes.
this point, right? And he says, I think so.
Yes.
It's such a weird moment.
He used the amnesia defense. He said that he believed his name to be Clark Rockefeller. It's actually genius because people had always called him that. Maybe they were mistaken. And you know, you don't actually know that your name is Doug Fabrizio unless you see your own birth certificate. You might say, well, people have always called me that. So anyway, at the trial, a trial where he did not testify, the prosecution had the luxury of putting up a Today Show clip from after his kidnapping arrest in which he sort of maladroitly and awkwardly tried to answer the questions of the interviewer about who he really was. I think his narcissism and his need for attention just, you know, moved him to go on the Today Show when he was about to go on trial for child kidnapping, not realizing that without the club room around him, without the paintings hanging on the wall, without the blue blazer, without the clean shaven face, he'd look as guilty and as cunning and as low down dirty as he really was.
There's this moment in the trial when a person who had been this man named Edward Savio, his parents took in Clark as an exchange student. This was in Connecticut.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, you know, he was a writer, and so he, as you say, was pretty well equipped to talk about Clark's process of reinvention. That was the thing you were talking about a minute ago. But one of the things you said in the book was that you felt this sense of recognition for yourself hearing about this, in the sense that you yourself had sort of, when you went to Princeton, there's this section in the book I want you to read, you yourself had settled into your own kind of persona. Do you want to set this up for us a little bit? Because I want to have you read this section, if you would.
Yeah. I mean, here I come from a little town of 500 in Minnesota, and I end up at Princeton University. There are fashions and intellectual concerns and all kinds of things with which I'm not familiar. And I try to create an identity for myself, as everybody does when they go to college, that will match my new surroundings. And so this is really just a description of how that process worked for me. Being myself at Princeton involved some guesswork, but eventually I settled on a persona. I bought a black thrift store raincoat and wore it everywhere, rarely taking my hands out of my pockets except when I had a chance to startle someone by whipping out my silver Zippo and lighting his cigarette with its oily flame. I wrote and helped direct a trio of imitation Beckett plays whose characters stood at strange angles to one another as they spoke their stiff, emphatic lines, which weren't to be confused with natural speech because there is no such thing as natural speech, not in the theater and certainly not in life, the most artificial form of theater, because it denies being theater at all. These were maxims I took from books by Frenchmen. The duty of the artist, I read somewhere, probably while I was smoking hash, which is when books about the artist's duty most appealed to me, is to show that artifice is all. That's why I wore my raincoat on clear days. That's why I ate Hershey bars for breakfast, dipping them in tea. That's why I told my actors to face the exit signs when they said, "I love you," to each other before walking off in opposite directions. That's why I wasn't surprised when certain classmates from rich New York families and stern New England prep schools began to nod and smile at me at parties, sometimes even slipping off to talk to me once their real friends were too drunk to notice. I was approachable for an angry loner. As the approaches grew more frequent, I wasn't even that angry anymore. The ugly raincoat just made it seem that way. The fact was that I yearned to ditch the thing. It bored me. But by then, it was part of my brooding playwright image, which was bringing me success with girls, especially the girls that I liked best, rich ones who'd spent years in therapy and treated sex as naked theater. In time, I would graduate from Princeton with highest honors, in part because I learned to speak the language of prestigious cultural subversion, the language of paradox, of endless loops, of ever-receding, ever-dissolving everything, of truth claims instead of truths, of paradigms lost. I left the place not knowing who I was or what I was or why I ought to care, since selfhood, I learned, is nothing more than this, a pronoun, I, a verb, to be, a tense, the present, and any grammatical sentence that starts this way, about which one cares to make a special truth claim. I am Walter Kern.
You mentioned in the book how it took you a long time, years, to repair, as you put it, your deconstructed world.
Mm-hmm.
You say the thing that helped you was writing about your past in the voice of the person before you had constructed this persona in Princeton. Is this where you sort of came to really understand this was the place you needed to write about? This was the most honest part of your life that you needed to write about?
Well, I was 28 when I wrote my first book of short stories, and I'd always thought my first book would be about some, you know, amazing metropolitan adventure with, you know, sexy women and lots of money in the background. But in fact, I started writing about living on this farm in Minnesota and my neighbors and being a Mormon, being an LDS convert, which was not a popular thing in Minnesota right then. And I realized that the me that had left for Princeton, anxious about his place, started making things up almost immediately, and that it was the years before that that I was sort of most organic, natural, and I needed to get back to that time in order to sort of restart the game.
There was a decision after the verdict. He's found guilty, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And you told someone nearby, another reporter who had been there in the courtroom with you for most of all of this, you said that you felt like you had just taken pleasure in a stoning.
Yeah. You know, I sat there watching Clark look up at photos of his victim's remains. I sat there next to the sister of his victim who was crying and dressed in black. And I was angry. I was disgusted with this guy. But when the verdict came down and the shock of this guy who's been skating his whole life is now going off to state prison for the rest of his life, I felt a little dirty. To, you know, they call it Schadenfreude in Germany, and it was an orgy of Schadenfreude right that moment. You know, this guy who thought he was better than everybody and could fool everybody had finally gotten his comeuppance. And once he had, I think I was no longer angry for a moment. I pitied him.
Yeah. And you couldn't leave it alone. I mean, it's at least I guess it was important to you to go, and you had more questions for him. You had to go visit him in jail.
You know, this is a book that sort of took off on me. Events kept changing as I went. I went to the murder trial not knowing whether he'd be convicted or not. I was afraid he wouldn't be. There might not have been a book if he hadn't been. Then as the trial ended, I thought, now I go off to write my book about him. And another reporter said, well, but why don't you go visit him in prison? I said, he hasn't had a prison visit for years. His lawyers won't allow it. And the reporter said, well, he just fired his lawyers. And what do I know? A week later, I'm sitting across from him in a visiting room at the L.A. Men's Central lockup, you know, and I'm looking through this scratchy glass at a guy I last knew as Clark Rockefeller and now know to be something like Hannibal Lecter.
It's interesting. There's this awkward moment when you first, before they turn the phone audio on, and you're sort of looking at each other. And then when it finally clicks on, he asks about your kids first.
Yeah, which I thought was an intimidation tactic.
Yeah. And then he asked you if you could get him a literary agent.
Yeah, yeah.
He had written this novel in pencil.
Yeah, he'd written, and I happen to know from highly placed sources in his camp, so to speak, that he'd been writing in prison the whole time and written like a 1,000-page novel with pencil. So the first thing he wants is a literary agent. He also wants me to give him a book on sonnets. He says he's into writing sonnets and he'd like a book on sonnet structure. That too may have been calculated to ingratiate him with me, you know, maybe if I'd come in and I was a marine biologist, he'd want to talk about fish, but he talked about writing and novels.
Let me ask you this finally, because it was part of that. It was almost, I guess it might have been the one of the last things anyway that you asked him.
Yeah.
You wanted to know, you said, how do you see people?
Yeah.
What do you mean by that? You wanted to get his sense of how do you figure human nature works? Of all the stuff you've been figuring out all this time, what was your conclusion about human nature, basically?
Yes, yes. He wasn't going to admit to the murder.
Yeah.
He blamed it on the missing wife. But I knew that he could not avoid acknowledging that he had been a con artist, that he had lied to people, that he had lived a life of imposture. And I asked, what allowed you to do it? What's the weakness in people that allows you to live a life like you have? And he said, Walter, I'm surprised you even asked. It's so easy. And then he paused, and I had to ask him again. And he said, it's this, vanity, vanity, vanity. You know, quoting Ecclesiastes from the Bible. And, hey, it may have been the only time he told me the truth.
Walter Kern, this book is called Blood Will Out, The True Story of a Murder, a Mystery, and a Masquerade. Walter Kern, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you.
Radio West, production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.